history. Thank you, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, first, can you tell us more on the importance of the recent elections in Zambia?
Zambia is a very important country in Southern Africa. They produced copper. It also borders Zimbabwe and Botswana and other important countries within the Southern African development community. They have, of course, faced some of the same problems that the international community has faced with the pandemic, the economic slowdown, and, of course, trying to import adequate mitigating medical supplies such as vaccines and other utilities that are needed at this time to address the social crisis in Zambia.
Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
Young people in Zambia face a difficult and uncertain future, mounting debt, growing joblessness, and rising costs of living. A young voter here speaks on his expectations after voting.
The things that I want is the leader that I'm going to vote for to deliver the promises that they've assured us during their campaigns.
What were the main issues during the campaign period that impacted on the voting patterns?
Principally the economy, and that is the major issue in Zambia throughout Southern Africa. There's been a decline in economic activity. Shops, which normally would be doing business, have been closed. People have been sickened. There's been an increase in the mortality rate. And of course, all the political parties have their own programs in regard to how to address the social crisis and the public health crisis. So a lot of the issues that Zambia is facing centers around the economic challenges that are imminent right now.
After the closely fought election in Zambia, the country is expected to face huge International Monetary Fund pressure to implement unpopular measures to ostensibly restructure the economy.
Mr. Azikiwe, the livelihoods of ordinary Zambians have been impacted negatively by the fallout from the debt crisis after the government ran out of money to pay its creditors. Now, how will the IMF austerity measures affect the masses in this African country?
Well, we've seen this, you know, over the last 50 years, where the obligations to the international financial institutions prohibit through the conditionalities that are, of course, imposed by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other institutions, which require the scaling back of public spending, and that also relates to public health, education, environmental issues, public transportation. So this is a major problem, not only facing Zambia, but countries throughout the entire Southern African development community. So inevitably, they will have to seek some renegotiation of their international debt obligations, which in many cases is not favorable to the African states.
Now, countries seeking assistance from the IMF are required to meet strict conditions, including the privatization of public services, deregulation of financial markets, and reduction of social spending, including on health. P.L.O. Lumumba, a renowned Kenyan lawyer and staunch Pan-Africanist, speaks here on IMF austerity measures targeting African countries.
After COVID-19, the IMF is back. They are telling almost every African country, they are telling Zambia, you know, they are telling Malawi, you know, they are telling Kenya, they are telling Tanzania, they are telling Uganda, you must do what we want. The structural adjustment programs of the 1980s is back, alive and well. And before you and me know it, we will once again be answering to the beck and call of these new neo-colonizers.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, how have the austerity measures advocated by the Bretton Woods institutions affected countries in Africa in general?
Well, both the institutions are the brainchild of U.S. imperialism. During the conclusion of World War II, the Bretton Woods Summit, which came up with the notions of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to rebuild Europe initially. But after the reconstruction of Europe during the post-World War II period, much of his focus has been on Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And that is the story of a tremendous amount of underdevelopment and destabilization across the African continent. So many countries today, despite a decade ago where you had tremendous and unprecedented economic growth in Africa, many of those countries now are being forced to renegotiate their international loans and also to seek new loans from these same institutions which have failed them on numerous occasions in the past.
Despite being Africa's largest producer of copper, Zambia remains one of the world's poorest countries. Even the miners have not been spared of the grinding poverty. A retired miner says he's yet to be paid his benefits. Western companies have been mining copper for decades in Zambia, even before the Chinese came into the picture. So why has the country failed to benefit from this natural resource?
Largely because they do not control the prices on the international market. This problem goes all the way back to the post-independence period under the first president and co-founder of modern Zambia, President Kenneth Kaunda. The prices drastically declined during the late 1970s, during the 1980s, and this, of course, caused him a lot of political problems inside the country. And in 1991, there was a multi-party election, and he was voted out of office. Now, the people who came in said they were going to do a better job in improving the economy, but here we are 3 decades later, and it's facing the same crises. So this is an ongoing problem. Many primary mineral and strategic resource-producing countries do not control the prices of the commodities in which they sell on the international markets.
The negative impacts of debt servicing have been deeply felt across Zambian households. Multiple factors contributed to the rising debt, including volatile copper prices, drought in 2019, and COVID-19. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, what should be the priorities of the incoming Zambian government?
Well, it will have to be to improve the living standards of the working people, of the poor, of the farmers, of the peasants, to open up direct dialogue with the broader civil society, and also work towards a regional solution to the problems of the Southern African Development Community. These problems are not just limited to Zambia. We have the problem in Mozambique, which historically Zambia has been very, very much engaged with. In northern Mozambique, where there's a Takfiri insurgency, and there's been a mobilization of African military forces from Rwanda and also from the South Africa, Botswana, to aid the Mozambican government in this attack by the terrorist organizations. This is something that no country in the SADC region will be able to ignore. So they'll have to deal with the international issues as well as the domestic issues.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Azikiwe, for your insight. Now let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss how U.S. e-commerce giant Amazon plans to set up its African headquarters in Cape Town in total disregard of the environment and South African heritage. Stay tuned.
Amazon disregards South African heritage.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
indigenous people in South Africa are protesting over plans by an American multinational technology company, Amazon, to build a new headquarters on a heritage site in the country's legislative capital, Cape Town. Now, speaking during a rally to condemn the plan, Reverend Alan Boysok, a famous anti-apartheid activist, said Amazon must stop its onslaught on South African heritage.
With this Amazon company, we are here to tell you, stop this onslaught on the history of our people. Stop the onslaught.
The affected communities are the Khoi and San, South Africa's first inhabitants. The land where the U.S. retail giant Amazon plans to build its African headquarters in Cape Town embodies victory and tragedy. It's in this land that the Khoi and San drove back cattle-riding Portuguese soldiers there in 1510 in one of the first and most successful anti-colonial battles in Africa. But a century and a half later, this was where Dutch settlers launched a campaign of land dispossession.
Now, to get an incisive analysis on this issue, we contacted Desmond Disa, an environmentalist and founder of the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. Thank you for your time. Now, first, can you tell us more about the significance of this heritage site and why it's sacred to local communities?
Well, the Okavango site is very important and very critical to the not only the tourism, but also to the survival of the indigenous people in South Africa. And for a company to come from outside and to really be destructive and take control over the ownership of the indigenous people of the country means that the land that's so critical for people, they will be left homeless.
Amazon is ignoring criticism over its attempts to acquire land originally occupied by indigenous people, with critics calling such moves examples of neo-colonialism. Torik Jenkins of the Gurigaikona Kwena Council, a Khoi traditional group, says the project is being carried out without the consent of South Africans.
After the city of Cape Town gave the go-ahead for a massive multi-billion rand development on the River Club with Amazon as its anchor tenant, we, together with 60 allies consisting of civic and environmental groups, including most of the Khoi and San, are fighting a final frontier battle for this ancient floodplain that is under imminent threat by, once again, the largest corporation on Earth. It wishes to put its African headquarters on top of the sacred floodplain with 150,000 square meters of commercial bulk, which goes against provincial, national, and international environmental policies as it violates the Paris Accords. And unfortunately, this is all being done in the name of the San and Khoi without their consent, and without the consent of the people of Cape Town, and without the consent of the people of South Africa.
Why is the American e-commerce giant Amazon disregarding the heritage of the people of South Africa and insists putting up infrastructure in this land?
Well, it's all about money. It's all about profit. And big companies do not see heritage, do not see the value of the land and the site, which has been precious and important to the people of this country, in particular the indigenous people. Companies like Amazon have abused their power. No matter where they've gone in the world, they've abused their power by using their money and being destructive in destroying the land, destroying the heritage and culture of people all over the world and even in the U.S.
Now, Amazon's proposed headquarters also poses serious environmental concerns and will violate Cape Town's established climate resilience policies. Now, an environmental activist speaks here against the project.
The city's own environmental management department says there's so many holes in this application: climate change, water, hydrology, flooding. It's inconceivable that the tribunal didn't consider those considerations.
Now, what's the environmental impact of Amazon's proposed headquarters in this heritage site in Cape Town?
Well, there are environmental impacts. The site itself, the land, it's got critical, important environmental that should never be touched, should never be destroyed. And that means that what will happen is that they're going to, using the land, they will explore for a host of things on that land and destroy it. And our concern is that no matter what you do, you're going to never rebuild it. You can never take it, is what they call offset it in another area, because the heritage of one land, one site, can never be developed in another area. And Amazon, by their actions, are going to destroy the site completely. And whilst they make huge profit, they will never be able to build that site anywhere else.
Cape Town City Mayor Dan Plato has defended the construction of the Amazon headquarters, saying it offers many economic, social, and environmental benefits for the area. Why have the local authorities given a green light for the project, despite protests by indigenous inhabitants of the region?
Well, the major problem that we face with in South Africa is that we've got a progressive constitution that guarantees the right for everybody, not only the right to food, but the right to the land as well. What is happening currently in South Africa, we're in turmoil. We're huge turmoil in the country, where 77% of the population lives on 13% of the land. And so the local authorities that are responsible for it, I have been on putting economic interests. And our government, if you read through what's going on currently in South Africa, most of our government officials are captured, well, what we call corporate capture. And a lot of them have conflicting interests, where they have shares in some of these companies, or their families have got shares into these big corporations that are offered shares, and therefore conflicting with the land.
Cape Town Mayoral Office says some indigenous groups are supporting the development, which will see their heritage virtually wiped out. Let's listen in to Cape Town City Mayor Dan Plato.
You mentioned the issue around the indigenous people.
Correct.
What is equally important is that the developer had some foresight. He had his own meetings and with the indigenous groupings in Cape Town, and I had equally had meetings with them, because if they can't get their way with the developer, with everything stops, the buck stops with the mayor's office, if I can put it to you like that, and people are rushing.
The developers claim that the project has been approved by the majority of the province's indigenous people. Is this true?
Because what they do is the developers go out and they bus in people from other parts of the country and bring them in and pretend that these are the indigenous. In fact, it's people looking for jobs. So people that look for jobs travel all over the country and move around in the country. And what really happens is that the industry signs these people up, and the consultants sign them up on the pretext that they're going to get jobs. Once the approval has been given, then jobs are going to be guaranteed for these people. So it's not the indigenous people of the land that occupy the current land. Those people, their lives have been threatened by the big corporations. And the people that have been offered jobs then go and threaten the lives of these people and tell them they must give up the land because jobs are needed and jobs are at stake. And that goes right through the government as well.
Opponents of this Amazon project are determined to derail it and want the area to be designated a World Heritage Site. Now, do you expect the will of the local people to prevail and eventually for these American multinationals to stop encroaching on their heritage site?
So the will of the people, they resolve to stand up and not allow the company to come onto the land is strong. And they will not allow the multinational corporation like Amazon to come on the land. They will have the support of all peace-loving people in South Africa who are very environmental conscious, who are also conscious of the land. This is something that we've been fighting for years to ensure that our people on the land have access to the land, plow the land, and protect the land for their families, but more importantly, for their children. So that will prevail. What will happen is, though, is that there is a local campaign around the entire country. And from the local, we'll take it to the national. From the national, it'll be taken to the continental. From the continental, we will take it to the international. So it'll be solidarity all the way, and Amazon will be boycotted all over the world. Similar plan and program was put together during the apartheid era, where the apartheid system was declared a crime against humanity, and people from all over the world came together and dismantled the power of the apartheid government. A similar thing is going to happen here. If Amazon wants to test the resolve of the people of South Africa and indigenous people, the people are going to stand up. The people will not allow Amazon to use its money to steal the land from the people of this country. A big corporation like Amazon should not be doing that. If they want to develop economic, they must come and discuss that with the people and ask the people what sort of economics do they want. The sort of economics that Amazon wants to bring here is going to destroy the land that will take generations to bring back to normal, and it might never ever happen to bring it back.
Well, there you have it. The indigenous people of Cape Town in South Africa are ready to lead an international boycott of Amazon if this American e-commerce giant insists on destroying their heritage. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's program. God bless you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, relationship with Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Muslims are supposed to feel connected to Allah and experience His closeness more than anyone else in His creation. After all, no one is more privileged and honored than Him, who is required to stand before His Creator in prayers and pray 5 times a day. Allah desires for us to have a relationship with Him and be close to Him, and to make it easy for us to have that relationship. He provided us with direction we need. He gave us a plan. And what is that grand plan? What is that master plan? We'll talk about it. And while we try our best to strengthen our relationship with Allah, many of us may find it hard to maintain or enjoy this bond with the Lord of the worlds. Many of us find ourselves hurting the relationship or cannot even feel it existed anymore. So what could be the reason for not feeling close to Allah? And what can we do about them? You know, there could be multiple reasons why we don't feel connected to Allah, why we don't feel that proximity and that closeness with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And these are the reasons that we would like to think about and ponder if we are suffering from this ailment. Otherwise, we are destined,
We are designed, we are cut out, and Allah has desired for us to be able to connect to Him and feel that connection, feel that proximity, feel that closeness. So why is it that some of us don't feel that? Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about relationship with Allah, and we said that He has desired and He has designed things in a way that we feel that proximity and closeness to Him. Now, why is it that some of us don't feel that? Well, one of these ways to find out or to rectify this issue of us not feeling that closeness to Allah is to contemplate and understand what our Creator says about having a relationship with Him. Much of the troubles we have, as scholars tell us, stem from misunderstanding the nature and requirements of the relationship. But once we appreciate it, all that remains is to struggle with forces within and without ourselves trying to realize it. So, brothers and sisters, contemplation and understanding how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looks at this relationship between Him and us, between Him and His servants, this is a good starting point. Once we get through this first post, that's when things start to fall in place. Let us begin with asking the following question. You know, once we start contemplating, sometimes we go like, what should I contemplate about? What question should I think about? So I'm going to roll out a question for your convenience, which would be a good starting point, hopefully, inshallah, for all of us. That question is, in our relationship with Allah, who is distant? Ask this question. In this relationship, who is distant? And if we do not yet feel Allah's presence in our own hearts, whose fault is it? So with this question, I'm going to leave you to contemplate in this quest of searching proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Four Saudis who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Julian Barnes, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled, Saudi Operatives Who Killed Khashoggi Received Paramilitary Training in United States. four Saudi nationals who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The instruction occurred as the secret unit responsible for Mr. Khashoggi's killing was beginning an extensive campaign of kidnapping, detention and torture of Saudi citizens, ordered by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, to crush dissent inside the kingdom. The training was provided by the Arkansas-based security company Tier 1 Group, which is owned by the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management. The company says the training, including safe marksmanship and countering an attack, was defensive in nature and devised to better protect Saudi leaders. One person familiar with the training said it also included work in surveillance and close quarters battle. There is no evidence that the American officials who provided the training or Tier 1 group executives knew that the Saudis were involved in the crackdown inside Saudi Arabia. But the fact that the government approved high-level military training for operatives who went to carry out the grisly killing of a journalist shows how intensely intertwined the United States has become with an autocratic nation, even as its agents committed horrific human rights abuses. It also underscores the perils of military partnerships with repressive governments and demonstrates how little oversight exists for those forces after they return home. Such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. The U.S. State Department initially granted a license for the paramilitary training of the Saudi Royal Guard to Tier 1 Group, starting in 2014, during the Obama administration. The training continued during at least the first year of former President Donald J. Trump's term in office. Louis Bremer, a senior executive of Cerberus Capital Management, Tier 1 Group's parent company, confirmed his company's role in the training last year in written answers to questions from lawmakers as part of his nomination for a top Pentagon job during the Donald Trump administration. The administration does not appear to have sent the document to Congress before withdrawing Mr. Bremer's nomination. Lawmakers never received answers to their questions. In the document, which Louis Bremer provided to the New York Times, he said that four members of the Khashoggi kill team had received Tier 1 group training in 2017, and two of them had participated in a previous iteration of the training, which went from October of 2014 until January of 2015. The training provided was unrelated to their subsequent heinous acts, Louis Bremer said in his responses. He said that a March 2019 review by Tier 1 Group uncovered no wrongdoing by the company and confirmed that the established curriculum training was unrelated to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Louis Bremer said that the State Department, in collaboration with other U.S. departments and agencies, is responsible for vetting the foreign forces trained on U.S. soil. All foreign personnel trained by the Tier 1 group are cleared by the U.S. government for entry into the United States before commencement of their training. In a statement, Louis Bremer said that the training was protective in nature and that the company conducted no further training of Saudis after December of 2017. the Tier 1 group management, the board, and I stand firmly with the US government, the American people, and the international community in condemning the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he said. A 2019 column by David Ignatius of Washington Post first reported that members of the Khashoggi kill team had received training in the United States. David Ignatius wrote that the CIA had cautioned other government agencies that some special operations training may have been conducted by Tier 1 group under a U.S. State Department license. The issue was central to Mr. Louis Bremer's contentious confirmation hearing and the written questions from senators asking him what role, if any, Tier 1 group had in training Saudi nationals who had participated in the Jamal Khashoggi operation. A State Department spokesman declined to confirm whether it awarded licenses to Tier 1 group for the Saudi training. This administration insists on responsible use of U.S. origin defense equipment and training by our allies and partners, and considers appropriate responses if violations occur, said the spokesman Ned Price. Saudi Arabia faces significant threats to its territory, and we are committed to working together to help Riyadh strengthen its defenses. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Saudi embassy in Washington did not comment. Former President Donald Trump weighed installing the head of Cerberus Capital Management, Steven Feinberg, in a top intelligence post last year, but the appointment was never made. While the Trump administration had appointed Mr. Feinberg to lead the president's intelligence advisory board in 2018, questions emerged about potential conflicts of interest. Cerberus Capital Management formerly owned the military contractor DynCorp, which among other things provides intelligence advice to the United States and other clients. It is unclear which members of the Khashoggi kill team participated in the Tier 1 group training. Seven members of the team belong to an elite unit charged with protecting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, according to an American intelligence report about the assassination declassified in February. The role of operatives from the so-called Rapid Intervention Force in the Khashoggi killing helped bolster the American intelligence case that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation. Members of the Rapid Intervention Force would not have participated in the killing without his consent, according to the report. The group exists to defend the Saudi Crown Prince and answers only to him, the document said. Members of the team that killed Jamal Khashoggi were involved in at least a dozen operations starting in 2017, according to officials who have read declassified intelligence reports about the campaign. Mr. Khashoggi, a columnist for the Washington Post, was killed inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. His body was dismembered using a bone saw. The assassination brought widespread condemnation of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to deny any knowledge of the operation. Eight defendants were sentenced to up to 2 decades in prison last year, but human rights advocates criticized the punishments as aimed at lower-level agents while sparing their leaders. The CIA concluded that the Saudi Crown Prince directed the operation, but Donald Trump said the evidence was inconclusive and that America's diplomatic and economic relationship with Saudi Arabia took priority. After President Joe Biden took office and debated the issue with his advisors before the release of the declassified intelligence report, his administration announced sanctions on Saudi citizens involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of the elite unit who protect the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. but President Joe Biden chose not to directly punish the Saudi crown prince. The earlier iteration of the training, which took place during the Obama administration, occurred before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman consolidated his power in the kingdom. His predecessor as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was a close ally of the United States and in particular of John O. Brennan, who served as CIA Director General under President Barack Obama. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was the Saudi counterterrorism chief and collaborated closely with the Obama administration officials. In 2017, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman pushed Prince Mohammed bin Nayef from power and executed a broader campaign to wrest power from his rivals, including a notorious episode of imprisoning Saudi royals and businessmen at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. The Trump administration considered him a valuable partner in the Middle East, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman developed a close relationship with Jared Kushner. The former president's son-in-law, who served as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the son of King Salman, is the next in line to the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef remains under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. The Tier 1 group website lists numerous American special operations and intelligence units as clients, along with specialty units that do not require recognition. It said it also trains OGA special operator teams, one pseudonym for CIA paramilitary units, as well as international allied forces. Under federal rules that restrict foreign sales of American arms and military expertise, Tier 1 group was required to apply for licenses to train the foreign operatives. Those license applications were examined by State Department officials who were processing tens of thousands of licenses per year, and they were approved. The approval would have allowed members of the Saudi Royal Guard to enter the United States on visas processed by the American Embassy in Riyadh. The path is similar to the one followed by Second Lieutenant Mohammad al-Shamrani, a Royal Saudi Air Force officer who opened fire in 2019 at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, where he was receiving military flight training. That attack killed at least three people and wounded eight others.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura, April 21st, 2010? The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, presented a deep analysis of her society's pathologies. She spoke firmly and eloquently in that difficult situation. It was not the case that she had an audience sitting in front of her and listening in silence. She was not speaking the way an orator would speak to his audience. She was surrounded by the enemies, holding spears in their hands. There were also some ordinary people there. The same people who gave up Muslim to Ibn Ziyad. The same people who wrote letters to Imam Hussein and then broke their allegiance to him. The same people who hid in their homes exactly when they were supposed to stand up to Ibn Ziyad.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Among the people, there were also some individuals who were not courageous enough to do what they should have done. And they were watching Imam Ali's daughter in tears on that day. Zainab al-Kubra was faced with this motley and unreliable crowd, yet she spoke in a firm manner. She was an exemplary woman in history. Such women cannot be considered weak. This faithful feminine nature may reveal itself in difficult conditions. She is a role model for all great men and women in the world. She presented a deep analysis of the problems facing the revolution started by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, in Imam Ali. She said, "You could not distinguish between right and wrong in the fitna. You were unable to fulfill your duty. As a result, they served the head of the Holy Prophet's grandson and put it on a spear. We can understand the greatness of her character when we consider such things."
Reporters.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
In its latest saber-rattling against Iran, Israel has said it may have to resort to military action against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz made the threat, accusing Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Meanwhile, the chief of the staff of the Israeli military made a similar threat, saying the regime is speeding up its, quote, operational plans against Iran. He also noted that Israel has recently approved a military budget to expand its capabilities against the Islamic Republic. Israel's blatant confessions of its warmongering policies come as it points to recent increases in uranium enrichment as evidence that Iran is racing toward producing a bomb. Israel has been alleging that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons since the 1980s, but it has failed to produce any evidence to support its claims.
Israeli aggression and attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran will be a matter of the existence of the Zionist entity. They are trying to bother from one time to time by cyber, digital, electronic warfare, but Iran is proven its capability of equality and competition among superpowers in this field.
Iran, on the other hand, has pledged that any aggression against it will be met with a decisive response regardless of where it comes from.
No one in Iran takes this seriously. The Israeli regime has just ended a major catastrophic loss in its conflict with the Palestinian people. So when the Israelis cannot defeat a Palestinian people who are surrounded in a concentration camp called Gaza, then the Israeli regime is in no position to talk about military confrontation with Iran.
Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but that Iran will give a crushing response to aggressors. Israel says it wants to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear arms, while Tel Aviv remains the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons. It was the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
Thank you.
suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following the Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about this Afghanistan operation.
After 5 days of marathon debates in Parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held. All but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the Parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister. With 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to Parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that Parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that Parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the President says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week, and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with Parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.